Hey, welcome everyone. My name is Erin Schaefer and I'm the Graduate Assistant at the Women's Center. I'd like to welcome you to our Spring 2012 Women on Wednesday series, Exploring and Making Visible Women's Intersecting Identities. This semester series on women's intersecting identities will explore the rich layers of women's multiple identities and how these intersections shape their lived experiences and perceptions. A few items before we get started. Please turn off your cell phones and also please remain seated until 12:50 as a courtesy to our speakers. Also, if you please fill out the evaluation forms, we use this for future programming. Please note that a pro-choice information picket will be held on campus this evening. If you're interested, we have more information in the back. And also, SDSU V-Day 2012 will present two performances of the Vagina Monologues this upcoming Sunday and Monday, benefiting the Women's Center's Gender Violence Prevention Program. Seats are limited, and so if you want more information, please see a Women's Center staff in the back. Our session today is titled, The Lives of Two Women with Disabilities. Our panelists will discuss the challenges and complexities of facing sexism and ableism, among other forms of discrimination. Our panelists today are Nikki Jagodinsky and Brittany Hernandez-Wilson. Nikki Jagodinsky is a graduate student at St. Cloud State University in the College of Counseling and Psychological, in Student Development Program and a graduate assistant at the Women's Center. She is diagnosed with juvenile rheumatoid arthritis at the age of 2. Nikki has her undergraduate degree in occupational therapy and several years of experience working with people with disabilities. She was recently selected to receive a $10,000 scholarship from the UCB Rheumatoid Arthritis Family Scholarship Program. This program receives over 600 applicants and recognizes 30 students nationwide who demonstrate educational success, promise, and ability to live beyond the limitations of rheumatoid arthritis. She is married and the proud mother of 2 daughters. Brittany Hernandez-Wilson is a student at St. Cloud State University pursuing a bachelor's degree in communication studies. As a member of a disability community, she strives to help educate and increase awareness on campus about the many issues impacting people with disabilities. In addition to being a feminist, Wilson is also a member of the LGBT community and is co-chair of LGBT Alliance, a student organization. We are very grateful to have them here with us today. Please join the Women's Center in welcoming Nikki Jagodinsky and Brittany Hernandez-Wilson. Okay, so first question. Would you tell us a little bit more about yourself, your disability, and other parts of yourself that make up your identities?
Yeah, can you guys hear me okay on this? Everybody here? All right. Well, as Erin said, I'm the mother of 2 children. That is probably, to me, my most important identity. They are 14 and 10 years old. I'm married. I am a graduate student. I'm a graduate assistant at the Women's Center. And I have lots of identities. And I would want to identify my least important one to me being that I have rheumatoid arthritis. But it does affect my life in many ways. I was diagnosed when I was 2. And it took about 6 months to actually diagnose me because doctors really couldn't figure out what was going on. Most people hear arthritis and they think of it affecting elderly populations or maybe from an injury, like a sports-related type injury, but there's over 100 different kinds of arthritis, and rheumatoid arthritis, the type that I have, is the most, usually the most debilitating. Growing up with arthritis, there was always challenges. Throughout my teen years, I used a wheelchair because I had a lot of physical pain and I had a lot of deformities and things like that that I was not able to walk or stand for long periods of time at all. So with my disease, it really fluctuates. It's a lot of up and down. Sometimes what I can do one day, I can't do the next day. And so, oftentimes, I kind of have a baseline that I function at right now, but sometimes that can suddenly change, and I can suddenly need to have a surgery or an intervention of some kind. So for me, it's dealing with a lot of those fluctuations is how it affects me. And just one more fact about JRA, there is 300,000 children in the U.S. that have juvenile rheumatoid arthritis, so not quite as uncommon as people might think.
Sweet. Hi, I'm Brittany, and as Erin said, I am majoring right now in communication studies, and I'm a senior, so that's exciting. I have been in a wheelchair my whole life. I was born with a birth defect called arthrogryposis, which basically means that when I was in the womb, I did not move around a lot, and so I didn't get the elasticity in joints that you would get, and so I have a lot of fixed joints, and I also developed around like half the muscle mass that the average child does, and so I'm not able to walk. When I was born, it was a lot more rare than it is now, and the doctors kind of gave my mom a very grim outlook on who I was expected to be and what I could do. They basically said that I was going to be in special education classes, that I would need help with everything, literally, and that I would be very dependent on people my entire life. So it was very, very grim and really hard, I think, for my mom to deal. I remember my mom saying that, you know, she was just devastated, I feel, as most parents would. At that time, they didn't have the technology to even detect that something may be wrong. So it was kind of like, oop, here she is. So my grandmother said to my mom, you know, if you tell her she can't do these things, or if you do everything for her, she's never going to learn. And I think that really resonated with my mom. You know, she would always push me to do things on my own and figure out how to do it, even if I got frustrated and wanted help. You know, she really pushed me to figure out and be creative, figure out how to do things. In addition to being in a chair, I'm also a woman of color, and also a lesbian. I came out about 2 years ago, and in the beginning I was really, like, I don't want to say obsessed, but I was really excited about finding this new part about me, and so it was just like, oh my gosh, gay everything. But now it's you know, it's been 2 years, I'm a lot more comfortable and more aware with my identity in that way, and so it's kind of, I don't want to say cooled down, but it's not as big of a deal as it was 2 years ago.
Okay. How have your multiple identities defined your life in big or little ways?
Me. Okay. I feel like being in a chair has always been the number one factor that people see when they look at me. I think that we're very visual, and so when you see me, you see my chair first. And so I feel like out of everything else, that is the number one thing that I always am reminded of constantly, something that I always have to think about in terms of accessibility. And so that was really, is always, I feel, going to define me. And then, as I said, you know, just coming out as a lesbian was a really, really big deal. And I feel like that's not something that you can really see, or something that you wouldn't necessarily assume when you look at me. And so, again, when I first came out, it was just everything was about that. And now it's really just kind of brought back down to, okay, like being in a chair and kind of just facing that again, in a way. Yeah, I would say that is definitely the biggest thing. And then also something is that if it's not one identity, it's kind of another. And I think that goes in with the whole oppression thing. You know, if it's not me being in a chair, then it's me being a lesbian. If it's not me being in a chair or a lesbian, it's me being a woman. If it's not me being in a lesbian in a chair, that's a woman. It's a woman of color. So it kind of is, I feel, a trickle effect. If it's not one thing, it's the other. And so it's a lot, I think, sometimes to carry.
For me, well, I can certainly relate to what Brittany was saying too. Because my illness does have its fluctuations, it's kind of always there. I'm always symptomatic to some extent, whether it's a very small amount or some days in a large amount. So it really mixes in with all my different roles in life. It mixes in with my abilities to be a mother and a student and a worker and all these different areas. But I really resist the notion that it defines me. I have never liked the term arthritic. In fact, in my family growing up, we never used that term. And my parents were very assertive about telling people if they did use that term to kindly not use that term. Because to say arthritic is, it's like that's all I am. It's so all-encompassing. And so I have fought against that. And yet there's so much I've learned from it too. And it's hard to deny that aspect of it as developing my identity. I'm certainly stubborn and determined and independent. And those are good things that have come from it. You know, when I was thinking about identities and how my rheumatoid arthritis has played into that, I was thinking back to some of my teen years. And maybe I thought of that because that was the time of my life when I was probably most physically limited, when I really did have to rely on mobility aids and a lot of surgeries and things like that. And I remember, as we're all too familiar with, the bombardment of media, how they portray women, how we are portrayed in the media as, you know, the expectations of a woman to, you know, have a perfect body and be beautiful and be shaped in this way and look exactly that way, and all these images that were given all the time. And when you're a teen, especially, I think those have a big impact on you because you're very influential at that time. And I remember, as a woman with a disability, or as a teen then with a disability, looking at my body with my crooked fingers and my scars on my legs and thinking, that's an impossible standard for anybody, but I will never even come close to that. And that was a really sad realization for me at the time, to feel even more alienated just from my own gender, you know, and realizing, of course, later that this was media influenced and not reality. But I do remember that struggle with, you know, kind of identifying as a woman too, but how to do it away from that stereotype. So.
Have you experienced ableism and or other forms of oppression? And what does this look like? Are there particular, do you have a particular story to share?
Kind of going off of the media with what Nikki was saying, I think that is one of the biggest forms of oppression that I've seen is just being silenced, not being a part of a media coverage. If you see someone with a disability, it's usually this like tragic story about how they overcame these huge obstacles and now they're living, and it's the story to make you feel really uplifted and really good about yourself, and it's there to make you feel like, oh yeah, you know, my life could be so much worse. Or it's something in the media that you see that you take pity, you say, oh, that, you know, that's really sad, or and it's never really seen as something that's like, this person is just living and they're no different from you. They may look different, but they do everything that you do. Or if they do something, they may do it in a different way. And that is something that I feel is a really big form of oppression, because it's not seen. When you do see it, I think you typically look away, or you want to stare. You want to get your stare on, and then it's rude. So I feel that that's one of the biggest for that I've seen and experienced. As far as what it looks like to me, I think that one of the biggest things is just being looked at as helpless and being undermined when someone meets you. I've had so many experiences when people, they'll meet me and I can just tell that they don't know what to say, they don't know what to do, they're just very like cautious with everything, and I can really feel that type of energy. And some days I completely challenge it and I'll go up and talk to those people specifically and just ruin their bubble, because I know that it's there and I really just don't care. And then there's other times when I'm just like, oh, I don't want to deal with this right now, you know, and I will just back away from them. But typically, I really just try to push myself to break their bubble, because I found so many times that it just takes a few minutes for someone to realize, like, oh, she's cool, or, you know, okay. And so most of the times I really try to push myself to do that. I think that in other forms, in a way, having a physical limitation, you're really kind of told what to do and what you can do. And it might not be outright, but it's there. And very subtle. An example that I have is that I am a part of LGBT Alliance, which meets at Thursdays at 7. What room is it? I always forget. Glacier Room, be there. But anyways, we're going to a conference this weekend, and they have never had someone in a chair go, and there's all these policies of what companies they can go through, who can drive, and on all this stuff. Well, the company that they only allow you to go through doesn't have any kind of accessible transportation for me. They don't have a policy. Went to the Disability Services Center, and they literally just said that if it's happened in the past, people have just driven themselves or found another way. And it's really sad, because you go to all these people and they look at you with blank stares. They have no answer for you. And the answer they usually come up with is go speak to someone else. And so I think that that's a perfect example that's happening currently right now, is where, you know, I'm forced to fight the system because they have no answer for me. And so there it is again, you know, you can't do this, but it's not said, you know. And so it's really about fighting the system and kind of paving your way. One more example real quick, sorry, I'm talking. So in every single bathroom in Atwood, there is no soap dispensers that are accessible. And so I went to the bathroom and I couldn't wash my hands, and I just it had happened before, but I just kind of like was like, oh, I'm sick of this. So I went into the administration office here, and I was like, hi, I can't wash my hands, and I went to the bathroom, like, nice to meet you. You know. And it was just kind of like, oh, well, we never thought of that. And it's just like, okay, well, you haven't, you know, but now you do. And so, you know, within a day, I had a janitor come around, like, with me, going to every single bathroom, being like, where do you want this? Where do you want this? And I'm like, yes, this is where I'd like it. Thank you. You know, but it's just little things like that. I think because you're silenced, because these issues aren't necessarily brought to the forefront, and in a way, I can understand, if you don't have to deal with it, if you don't have a friend or a family member or an acquaintance, it's unlikely that you really think of that. And so I think that being silenced is definitely, it makes sense, I guess, why you wouldn't see those things.
Yeah, I can understand, again, a lot of what you're saying, but I'm glad we have the term ableism. I was thinking about this because once we identify something, once we name it, we call it that, we really have a reason to talk about it. We really have the language that we need to talk about it. Because it wasn't until like the early to mid 80s that the term ableism really started being discussed and used. And when you think about that through the context of how long social change takes, oftentimes, unfortunately, it's still a relatively new concept in that, you know, when you put it in that perspective. I think there's still a lot to be done. Brittany gave some good examples of that. We had the ADA, which has been immensely wonderful in helping to improve accessibility for people, but there's still work in those areas for sure. I could tell many stories where I personally have experienced ableism, and like Brittany, I also understand it because it is a hard thing to see. It is a hard thing to fully grasp unless you have had personal experience with it. I remember being young and elderly people feeling really bad for me and wanting to give me money, which my mother never let me take ever. And I remember people
total strangers approaching me like in the mall or something and wanting to pray with me, or cast demons out of me. I've had that happen as well. You know, just odd things that are so really socially awkward and not really appropriate, and you just think, why? What is this about? Just because I'm sitting in a chair or because I'm limping or whatever, you know, suddenly they feel this need and this pity that is just really takes away your power. From more recent times in my life, one of the most, what I think of when I think of ableism is many people telling me not to have children. And some of these people were probably well-intended and really did care about my well-being, but it's not their choice. It's my choice. And even my doctors, a couple of them said, you know, this is going to be hard for you, and you really shouldn't do this. And I thought, you need to ask me if I want to and not tell me, because this is a big deal. And of course, I did choose to have children, and they are wonderful, and I have enjoyed that piece of my life tremendously. And I just told my doctor at the time, well, this is what I'm choosing, and you're my doctor, so figure out how to take care of me through it, and we'll make it work. So again, you know, ableism as far as like having limited choices and feeling pity, which is just yuck. I do have just one more stay on time, but I have a story to share about a time that I was actually an ableist, which it just shows you how difficult it can be sometimes. I used to work at Camp Courage, which is a camp for physically disabled adults and children. And I started there very young when I was 18. I worked for many years, and a lot of my heartstrings are still there, and I do help there now and then when I get a chance. In my first summer there, I was talking with one of the campers who was there, and I'm going to call him John just out of respect, but John has since passed on, and I am sure that he would get a good laugh out of me sharing this story. but John was quite dependent. He had, you know, pretty significant limitations. He used a wheelchair that laid down, and he had virtually no movement of his own, and he was institutionalized. And coming out to camp was a great experience for him because he got to be away from his institutionalized lifestyle. And I was having a conversation with him, and he was very difficult to understand. His speech was very slow and very drawn out and very, very soft. And I was really struggling in the conversation to fully understand. And I kept, you know, leaning in and listening. And I asked many times, I'm sorry, John, can you repeat that? I'm trying, you know, to understand. And eventually I just started guessing what I thought maybe he was saying. Are you hungry? Are you thirsty? Do you need to use the bathroom? Would you like to go back to your cabin? I had guessed pretty much everything under the sun. And I said, please be patient with me because I'm going to get that. And he was humorous about it. I mean, he was laughing. He thought this was actually hilarious that he was, you know, able to make this 18-year-old girl just blunder and lost her. Like, and finally, I thought I heard what he said, and I said, I think I understand now what you're asking me. And I said, but I want to make sure. I said, did you just ask me if I like Greek mythology? And he said, yes. And so this was an example. You know, I had made the horrible assumption that because he had significant physical limitations, that he also had intellectual limitations, and I was so wrong. I mean, we had a wonderful conversation about Greek mythology, which was much easier now that I knew what we were talking about. so that's just an example of how, you know, even how pervasive it really is, that even though I had had personal experiences in my life experiencing ableism, even I portrayed that image. So it was a learning experience for sure.
In what ways would you want to change the way people see other people with disabilities?
I think the biggest thing for me would be for people to just see me as me. And Nikki and I were talking yesterday about it, and it was just kind of like, take a chance, you know, take a chance and talk to someone who maybe looks different or who you might assume that, like, you know, they might not be able to do this or that, you know, take a chance and get to know them. You know, you may meet your future best friend or even fall in love with someone. You never really know. And I think it comes back to this whole thing of just judging a book by its cover. I think that we all do it, you know, and it's whenever we meet anyone, we look at them and we make assumptions about what they look like. And I feel that for people with disabilities, unless you have previous experience that's, I guess, positive, it's really easy to just push that person away or to not look at them or to not talk to them. And so I think just try to be open. And kind of going a little bit back here, even if you may feel that someone may have a cognitive, that they're not, I don't know what I'm trying to say, basically if you feel that someone may be a little kind of slow in their cognitive abilities, one thing that I always run into is when I'll be talking to someone and I'll be with a friend and they'll be talking to my friend, like answering questions that I'm asking them, talking to my friend. And I really just want to run them over and be like, look at me. Oh, it's so annoying. So I think that if people could just be open and really kind of just try to see someone for who they are and for not what they look like, I think that that's one of the best things that you can do.
Yeah, I certainly have to agree with that. Again, I mean, Brittany and I have talked about our many, many identities. You know, there certainly is more to each of us than what might be what you first notice. For me, the thing I would want to change is the attitudes that are kind of pervasive in ableism, just assuming that, you know, a person with physical limitation is less capable than a person who doesn't have physical limitations, and we all have our strengths and we're all valuable people. I also have written down here in my notes an explanation point after it, stop pity. I have this gut reaction when I hear pity. It just is oppressive, and particularly if you're feeling sorry for someone based on how they function, it's just a different way of being. It's not, it's kind of a silly thing if you think about it. If you really think about it, it's kind of silly to feel sorry for someone when, you know, Brittany and I and many other individuals that I know with disabilities are very well-adjusted, happy people who are contributing to society. You know, I often hear the pity. And to find the commonalities and the common connections that even if you don't necessarily understand what someone is coping with related to their physical limitations, there's something about them that you will understand. There's something that you'll be able to relate to. Like my friend John and I from Camp Courage, we had a great conversation about mythology. We were both interested in it. Related to pity, Gabrielle Giffords, the congresswoman from Arizona who was injured tragically, has recently resigned. And when she resigned, it was said on the House floor the day that she resigned that she was, quote, the brightest star this Congress had ever seen. And a little bit of me thought, oh, that's nice, but yet I have this twinge too. Because it felt a little bit like pity to me, and I had to think about it and ask myself, would they have said this about her if she hadn't been injured? Again, what happened to her was a tragedy, and the ability to find strength in tragedies is admirable, and I hope as a country we all learn when we have these tragic things happen in our country. But this is a quote from Gabrielle's resignation letter, okay? It says, I fought for what I thought was right, but never did I question the character of those with whom I disagreed. Never did I let pass an opportunity to join hands with someone just because he or she held different ideals. That's amazing.
Gabrielle Giffords isn't more admirable because she has physical challenges. Gabrielle Giffords was always worthy of admiration. So,
what recommendations or messages would you like to impart to the audience about ways to improve the lives of people with disabilities?
I kind of touched on that, I guess, a little bit in my last question. Has anyone ever seen Little People, Big World? Okay. Do you know in the introduction when the mom is saying, we can do just about everything, but just in a different way? I think that's kind of, when I first started watching Little People, Big World, and when she would say that, I'd always be like, yes, because I feel like that's true. You know, I had, like, the Swiffer sometimes is my best friend because I will use that to, like, get things that I can't reach. Or, you know, my hands are curved. And so sometimes when I'm with my friends, you know, and they see that maybe I'm struggling a little bit or something like that, they'll just look at me and they'll just be like, can I help you? Like, they'll want to help. And I can just see the tension in their body. I'm like, no. It just looks like it. Like, no, I don't need help. It just looks like it. So I think one thing that people can do and take away from this is just to realize that if someone is doing something different, that's okay. I take a lot of gratitude from doing things my own way. For the first time, like a month ago, for the first time in my entire life, I did the laundry by myself. And I can't tell you how amazing that felt because the washers are top load, I think that's what it's called. It's hard for me to like get in and get the clothes. And so my mom always did my laundry. And so I realized that if I just tilted back my chair can tilt, if I scoot to the edge and I tilt, that I can like actually lean forward and get them. And I was so excited. It was just like magic to me. I'm like, oh my gosh, these clothes are dirty and now they're not. This is amazing. Because usually I'd have to wait. And so it's really honestly the little things like that. Yesterday when we were talking to Nikki and I, we kind of just opened this whole conversation about helping and assuming. And something that I really want to say is that, you know, the things that I've talked about, while some, they are very relatable to other people, you know, they're my personal experiences and my beliefs and things that I've learned, and it could be completely different for someone else. And so I think it's really important to realize that, you know, everyone is their own person, and they may have different experiences with other things, and so what you learn here, yes, while it is important, please try to not generalize it to the whole disabled community, because it's not everyone's story.
Yeah, we're all as different as we are. I mean, it is unique for everybody. I do think the question of helping is something that people wonder about a lot, how much to help, when to help. Again, for me personally, I'd say you can always ask, and please know that most individuals that I know with disabilities are pretty good about asking as well if they need help. Another piece of advice I have, and this has really gotten more attention to in recent years, is to really start noticing language that we use when we talk about physical limitations. When you hear the word wheelchair bound, think about that word a minute. Literally means tied to something. Bound is tied. So that's a very victimizing kind of a term. We say that somebody suffers from something or they're stricken with something. Again, this is very, you know, it has those tones of victimization in it, and it can be very disempowering. Everybody knows that, I'm sure it's been talked about many times, there's a lot of PSAs about it, people using the word retarded casually in conversations. I would encourage you to just, you know, make note of those things and correct it if you feel comfortable.
you know. We talked a little bit about the physical barriers, and Brittany shared the challenge with the transportation company. That's exhausting. I mean, there's still a lot to overcome with as far as access issues go. So that's another way another thing to take away from here is to just think about barriers that you see when you're walking around campus or different places that you go in your life. Start noticing that. Start asking yourself, how would an individual who was using a wheelchair get in here? Would they be able to do it, and how would they be able to do it? It bothers me when wheelchair accessible entrances are somewhere that isn't typical or normal. I hate it when they're around the back of the building. What is that? We're not good enough to use the front door? I mean, and you know, this is how slow some of this social change is, because we are still making these adjustments. We are still, you know, accommodating that. But just take some time to kind of notice those things. And I would even go so far as to say, if you're really interested, rent or borrow a wheelchair and see what it's like to spend a couple of hours maneuvering around the barriers that are around us and in our world. And I would encourage you to do it somewhere that is not where you don't know anybody, you know, like at a mall or somewhere else, so that you can see what it feels like to be in that situation, you know, see how people react to you and the different challenges that you have navigating the environment. It's an interesting experiment. It does make you appreciate it on a different level. Again, I do agree with what Brittany said. It's personal for everybody. Don't be afraid to ask. Never assume. Never assume that you know, we don't know any more about the things that, you know, the person we talking to, dealing with, regardless if they have a disability or not. And to assume that leads to trouble. Problems.
On one more thing about that too, I think being an ally to the community is something that everyone should do. For example, has anyone ever been to the White Horse ever or heard of it? That's one of my favorite places to go, and they don't have a ramp. And yes, people can, I guess, like give me a wheelie and push me up the curb, but it was just like one curb. And the owner, Brian, I was like, Brian, what are you doing? Like, no, you need to get a ramp. It would be super easy. You can do it. And like every single time that anyone that I knew would go in there, they would just hassle him about it. So a couple weeks later, I go and he has one. He's like, I made it, like, just for you. I was like, yes. And I've seen other people in chairs too that one time I was in there and someone else came and they're like, oh, they got a ramp. And I was like, yeah, you know, like telling them that I and my friends had hassled them to do that. I think to some certain extent that if people aren't necessarily aware, they've never, in terms of like businesses and places, if they have never had someone that has is in a wheelchair or uses things to get around, they may have never experienced it. And so sometimes it really just takes that push to kind of open their eyes. So I think that being an ally is really important. And if you see something, you know, say it.
Yeah, I don't think that social change ever comes without allies. It's needed big time. And I too remember people being surprised. I mean, I don't think people are intentionally not being accessible. I don't think it's often thought of or realized until it's brought to somebody's attention or they have a personal experience with it. I remember being in a wheelchair and trying to navigate the clearance racks in the store, you know, they just jammed in and it couldn't get through them. And I remember very nice clerks apologizing all over the place, saying, we didn't even think about making these accessible. Because it really does take commitment and effort and awareness, so much awareness that goes into this, and that is why allies really are important, for sure.
Okay, we have about 10 minutes for questions or comments. Yes.
Like, what do you, like,
I feel like part of it is just my personality. I can just be really outgoing sometimes, and like I said, you know, when people are like anxious sometimes, or not anxious, but they are just nervous to talk to me, they don't know what to do, you know, I purposely just ruin their bubble because part of it is fun, but you know, also it's good to do that. I think that as with everyone, you have your ups and down days, you know, and so I feel like in some respects, definitely you have to be stronger, especially if you want to see change or if you want to bring attention to people. You have to be strong, and in a sense, you almost have to get mad. You have to get really mad about it, and you have to put on your game face, and you have to not accept no for an answer. So yeah, and I think sometimes also you really, it just takes that one person to say something or to really get somewhere.
Yeah, we had talked about that yesterday a little bit, you and I, about the strength that it does bring out. And I do think that for a lot of individuals that might come from an oppressed minority, they may be able to relate to that feeling of wanting to be empowered and fight this, and then on the flip side of it, just going, oh, I'm done. I don't want to think about this anymore. You know, it's exhausting sometimes. And I know for me personally, it's a really good support system, and that is key, because when I do feel exhausted, they can pick that up for me and, you know, be understanding and give me the support that I need to take care of myself too. So, and like I said, with my disease, it just so wildly fluctuates, and sometimes I think that's hard for people to understand, because what I could do one day, I can't always do the next week, and sometimes that takes a lot of assertiveness on my part to explain to people. It could be easily misperceived as, well, I'm just not trying, or she has an excuse, or, you know, and it's very real. So, and as far as being strong, yeah, I've felt that almost my whole life. I had my knees replaced for the first time when I was 17, and many surgeries before that. And I always did feel like I had to put on this brave face. And most of the time, I was surrounded by such wonderful people and support that I really did feel it. But sometimes I just didn't. I just wanted to kind of cave and let myself be sad in it about it for a while. So,
yes.
Yeah, in case you guys couldn't hear, but the question is kind of on parenting and how you adjust your own, you know, take care of your own illness needs and the accommodations that you might need. Explain that to your kids and deal with that with parenting. That can definitely be a real challenge. Something for you to look up. It's called butidontlooksick.com. I'm advertising this website right here because it's a great website. And there's a story written in there by a woman about living with her chronic illness, and it's called the spoon theory. And I think your children are old enough to understand the spoon theory, and it has really helped our family to have a common language where it talks about kind of starting the day with a bouquet of spoons, and then every activity we do kind of takes a spoon away, you know, and we have to make those choices carefully. Like if I decide to mop and vacuum my house, I'm going to have to give up 2 spoons for that, and then I might only have a few left for later. And so my children have come to understand the concept of spoons, and I'm able to say to them, okay, Mom only has 3 spoons left for the day, I'm thinking. I'm feeling I have about 3 spoons. So here's what I need to do with at least 1 or 2 of them. Let's decide what we can do together with 1 of them. And my children have kind of also become good at, there's certain things that they do with Dad, and there's certain things that they do with Mom. And that's probably common in a lot of families, regardless of illness. And it does, there's times when they get frustrated with the illness too, for sure. There is times.
having the common language helps, and sometimes those really special things that only I do with them, that, like, singing. I don't know. My husband's not a good singer anyway. But sometimes that helps, too. But check out that website, and I think that, you know, it can be beneficial to have that language.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Do you have any other last thoughts for the audience?
Got any thoughts?
No. I guess just thank you for coming.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's thank our presenters.